I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more engaging, highly readable, and fascinating reads you'll have this year will be the book from Meredith Wadman, The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. It looks at the era beginning in the early 1960s, when biologists in Philadelphia began using tissue extracted from an aborted fetus from Sweden that produced safe, clean cells that allowed for the creation of a number of vaccines. Meredith Wadman joins me now and will discuss the people in her book, from biologists and vaccine developers, the politics around it all, and the large sums of money the pharmaceutical industry has derived from all the research that's yielded life-saving vaccinations for millions of people around the world. Meredith Wadman was born in Vancouver and went on to complete her education at UBC Medical School and Oxford, where she is the second female Rhodes Scholar ever from British Columbia. She later studied journalism at Stanford and Columbia. She has covered biomedical research from Washington, D.C. for over 20 years now, reporting for Science as well as Nature, Fortune, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. This new book is published by Viking. Please welcome to the Planta Online program from here in Vancouver today, Meredith Wadman. Dr. Wadman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So, you know, one of the fascinating things about your book and the enjoyable things is how engaging it is. I don't know why I didn't think a book on vaccines would be interesting or gripping or fascinating, but I was just engrossed by it. So would you take us to where vaccines were at the early 60s? I mean, the vaccines had been around since the 1800s, right?
Right, but there had not been any really great public health victory from vaccines until the Salk vaccine against polio was introduced in 1955, shortly followed in about 1961 by the Sabin polio vaccine. And between those two, it was just a huge, enormous, impressive victory and a great relief, because polio had been a real terror, like terror on the likes of Ebola terror on the continent of North America in those days. So that was like pretty much the poster child for vaccine success in the early 60s. You didn't, you know, at that time have measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis A, chickenpox, and numerous other childhood vaccines. You had basically smallpox as a routine childhood vaccination, and you had, by the early 60s, polio. Oh, and, sorry, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus as well. I should credit those. They came along a little earlier. But, yeah, it wasn't what it is today in terms of the childhood vaccine schedule.
And I guess what what makes the book, so such an enjoyable book is you take us to these three personalities I guess I'd heard of Stanley Plotkin before.
Yeah, he's well known as the inventor of the rubella vaccine, that is the R in today's MMR vaccine.
Yeah, and so Leonard Hayflick, Hillary Kaprowski, Stanley Plotkin. How did these three first come together? When and where was that?
That was in the late 1950s in Philadelphia at this sort of hoary old medical research institution called the Wistar Institute. It was this elegant brownstone tucked on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, independent of the university. It had been around nearly 70 years. And while it was elegant on the outside, inside it was kind of a creepy mausoleum, a bit of a relic of 19th century American medicine. And Hillary Kaprowski, this brilliant polio vaccine pioneer, a Polish emigre who was like a polymath and a concert piano player and a connoisseur of fine wines and women and everything else good in life, and a brilliant scientist, came along and basically, under his guidance, the Institute was reborn beginning in about 1957. He turned it into a hub of biological research, first-rate biology research and first-rate biologists. By about 1960, it was a real go-to place for outstanding scientists. And then in 1958, he hired this up by the bootstraps working-class Philadelphian named Leonard Hayflick, who was one generation out of poverty, very bright, very ambitious, and none of the other things that Kaprowski was in terms of culture and urbanity and worldliness. And Kaprowski kind of saw Hayflick as a research assistant type, someone hired to create cultures of cells grown in lab dishes to serve his first-rate cadre of international esteemed biologists. And Hayflick was having none of it. Yes, he did his job making the cells for the biologists, but he wanted to do his own thing, too, and make his own mark in biology. And that's kind of where the story leads. The third character, Stanley Plotkin, had been hired by Kapowski in the late 1950s as his polio development lieutenant. Plotkin was also an up-by-the-bootstraps guy from the Bronx, and he really wanted to create vaccines against childhood diseases because he was a pediatrician with a big heart for kids.
And so was there a sense, as we when they first come together in the late 50s, that they could tackle and defeat these diseases, these childhood diseases that you've mentioned already? I mean, was that something that they could foresee, say?
It was, because in the late 1940s, a scientist named John Anders, working with a couple of colleagues in Boston, had shown that polio virus could actually be grown in human cells in lab dishes, and that had opened the way to the creation of a polio vaccine. And Anders' techniques showed that you could capture, I mean, in principle, the world was open now to virologists. All kinds of viruses could be grown in lab dishes. And that was essential for being able to make a virus vaccine, because virus vaccines in the days were either viruses that had been replicated and produced in quantity in cells in lab dishes and then killed, often with formaldehyde, and then injected so that they produced an immune reaction, or they had been grown in cells in lab dishes and weakened. Viruses, basically, by being grown through generations of cells in lab dishes, get better at growing in lab dishes, but less good at causing disease in the human body. And so they could be injected as weakened live virus vaccines and produce a good immune response, good antibodies that would protect the vaccinee in the future, but not cause the disease in the person. That, at least, that was the goal, and it was a fine balance that they had to pursue. But in any event, the Enders technology that emerged in the late 40s opened the door to virus vaccine making.
And so these cells, WI-38, which I guess they had been generated from the fetus of an aborted fetus from Sweden, is that right? And so what set those cells apart from, say other cells, say previous cells?
Well, previous cells, human cells grown in lab dishes, had almost all been cancerous. If they didn't begin as cancerous cells, they turned cancerous with time. And vaccine makers wanted to have nothing to do with making vaccines in cancerous cells, because the fear was they might cause cancer in the people that were vaccinated.
Right.
And so what Hayflick did in deriving these WI-38 cells from this aborted fetus from Sweden was to demonstrate that his cells were normal. They did not turn cancerous in lab dishes. And moreover, they were not infected. They were clean. They were mini micro vaccine factories that vaccine makers could safely use. Now, it needs to be said that the aborted fetus that these cells, the lungs of which these cells were grown from, came from a woman I call Mrs. X in the book to protect her privacy, who had no idea her fetus had been taken and didn't learn until several months after the abortion that this had in fact happened. And that was standard practice in the day. Physicians had a sort of sense of entitlement, and scientists, to use human people's tissues without so much as a by your leave.
Yeah, and then this is a great discussion that you have throughout the book of the ethics of it all, because not only what happened to Mrs. X, but vaccines were tested on all sorts of people without their knowledge, like prisoners and the handicapped and the sort, right?
That's right. Generally institutionalized populations who were powerless to say no, including 1- and 2-year-old orphans in an orphanage run by the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and children, young adults in homes for juvenile offenders, state homes, institutionalized disabled people, often children with serious mental impairments, premature babies on the charity wards of the main hospital for black people in Philadelphia. I shouldn't say it was like an apartheid system, but it was the hospital that African Americans chose because it treated them well. And then in the end, their babies were essentially experimented on without their consent.
Yeah, a lot of people might know of Henrietta Lacks because of that book that came out a few years ago, and certainly we'll know more about her once this movie starring Oprah Winfrey comes out in the next month or so. Mrs. X is comparable to her. And I guess in the course of the book we find out that you found her.
Yes, in 2013 I was able to track her down in Sweden. She was still alive at the time. I don't know if she is now. My translator was able to speak with her and to ascertain that she did not want to go back in time and tell her story, and I have to say, who can blame her?
Yeah.
She had no knowledge or interest in the uses that have been made of her fetus's cells, but she did say, I didn't know about this, and they didn't ask me, and this would never be allowed to happen today.
Yeah. But just in terms of the numbers of who's benefited from those cells, I mean, hundreds of millions of people are alive today because of them, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, it's in the hundreds of millions. Merck has shipped nearly 700 million doses just of the rubella vaccine made using these cells. Rubella, also called German measles, was a terrible bane through the 1960s because, like Zika, if you or I get the disease, it's a mild thing. Maybe we have a rash, maybe we don't, maybe we spike a fever, maybe we don't even know we're ill. It's so mild.
Yeah.
And yet, if a pregnant woman is infected, particularly in her first trimester, it is devastating on the fetus. There are times in the first trimester of pregnancy when 100% of fetuses are damaged if the mother is infected with rubella. And the damage is, the virus infects virtually every fetal organ. So at the time of a major epidemic in 1964 and 65 in the States and in Canada, tens of thousands of babies were born blind, deaf, intellectually disabled. They had shrunken heads like you see in the Zika babies.
Right.
They had hobbled hearts with various heart deformities, and they had combinations of these conditions. So it was just tragic. There were far more babies born damaged during that one epidemic than were damaged by thalidomide in its entire time on the world market.
Right.
And there was no vaccine.
Yeah. You mentioned Zika a moment ago. What happened over that? What does that say about the future of vaccines?
What happened over that, meaning the
whole political argument of it, the vaccine couldn't get to certain people in time, there was a great debate in Washington over it. And
right. So it was held up on Capitol Hill in Washington from February of 2016 when then President Obama asked for $1.9 billion American dollars to battle the virus and make a vaccine till September of 2016 when Congress finally freed up the funds. And in that space of time, 1,500 babies were born damaged by Zika. The number is now close to 3,000 in total in about 29 countries. So I think what it says is that for Zika and for other infectious diseases that will emerge, it's not a matter of if but when,
yeah,
we need to have a politically insulated fund that scientists can draw on to quickly move into vaccine development. We can't foresee what's coming, but we can be prepared, and prepared with money that can't get hung up in political debates.
What do the scientists tell you that you cover in your work as a journalist about, say, the climate at the moment with regards to this new administration?
It's extremely dispiriting. The proposed budget that the president is putting out has major and some would say crippling cuts to research budgets within agencies like the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which collects climate data, like the Environmental Protection Agency. But the bottom line is that in finding $54 billion with a B dollars to boost the U.S. military, the president is finding an equal amount of cuts in other agencies, and some of those are science agencies, and it's really terribly alarming.
One of the things that people might, we all have heard about the discussion about vaccines as of late, in terms of, and not just about the pharmaceutical industry and how make so much money off of research and the sort, but just about the safety of vaccines today. We hear conspiracy theorists saying that you know, it gives kids autism and the sort. Are they being irresponsible, or is that fear founded somehow? I mean, did those fears happen, say, in the era that you talk about in the book, in the early 60s, say?
The autism fear is completely groundless. It's been redundantly disproven. There is no link between vaccines and autism, full stop. Any substance, that you put in the human body, whether it's an arthritis drug or an MMR vaccine, there is a risk-benefit ratio. So, for instance, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine rarely, by which I mean maybe on the order of 1 in 100,000 to 1 in a million kids, may cause a febrile seizure. That's a real risk. That's one that has been documented and is surveyed carefully for. The unreal risks and the sort of alternative fact risks are the ones that I think are driving the anti-vaccination movement, which I would like to say, while loud, is small. And that has been shown recently in a Pew Research survey that showed that 88% of adult Americans support vaccination, believe in its safety and effectiveness. So I think what we need to come back at these ideas with are, I have coined three E's. Empathy, because we all understand what it is to want to protect our kids. Of course we do. But also evidence and education, because the facts really do speak on the safety of vaccines. A letter went to President Trump just last month from 350 medical organizations, and its message was simple. Vaccines are safe, vaccines are effective, vaccines save lives.
Yeah. And so when you look back at this era that you write about in the book to today, the confidence that people have in vaccines, I mean, has that always been the same, or is it because of where we are in our media and our culture that these conspiracy theorists and these crackpots, that they have, say, a louder voice than they previously would have?
They do have a louder voice, and it's because vaccines have become, to an extent, a victim of their own success, in that the diseases they prevent, we don't see anymore. We don't see the kids in leg braces or wheelchairs from polio. We don't lose toddlers to measles when it invades their lungs or brains. We don't see children suffocated literally by diphtheria. And so we forget, and we think, well, I don't need to vaccinate my kids because these diseases aren't floating around out in the community anymore. What is the fundamental misunderstanding there is that these diseases do not have a foothold in our communities precisely because we continue to vaccinate. And when we fall below 9 to 9.5 out of 10 toddlers being fully vaccinated, we are playing with fire in terms of inviting these infectious diseases back into our communities.
Yeah, we just take them for granted, don't we?
We really do, and I think it's really important to recover the stories like the rubella story and the vaccine race to remember what the battle days looked like, because they were really bad.
Yeah. Kirkus Reviews, when they wrote about your book, said that this would make a great film adaptation. Have you thought of say, certain actors in mind for some of these folks that you write about?
I've thought of a younger George Clooney to play Stan Plotkin, but, you know, this is when I'm fantasizing, because who knows if someone will want to develop it into a movie. Have you thought of someone who would make an apt actor for a certain role?
You know, it's funny in reading the book, because you're quite evocative in how you describe them. You know, I have certain types in mind, but not specific actors, no. Yeah, but it's fascinating when you read a book, you know, your mind automatically, you know, roams around in terms of trying to picture these people. I mean, there are photographs in the book of these folks, but still, you know, you'd draw a picture of who Mrs. X looks like even, right?
Right. Well, I would see her sort of, her face isn't pictured, it's just kind of gray in the background,
yeah.
Right? Because she hovers in the background of the book that way.
Yeah. You were born in Vancouver?
I was born and raised here. I went to McGee Secondary School, and I did my first 2 years of medical school at UBC.
Yeah, so do you get out here often?
I come out twice a year generally, for my mom's birthday in March and to see the whole family in August.
Yeah, well, because we're talking about what Vancouver is like today and what it might look like in the future, because it's changing rapidly. I mean, I live here, but I mean, you know, there's certain parts of this town that are unrecognizable,
yeah.
You know, 2 years ago. What's it like coming back for you?
Oh, it's very strange. I feel a bit of a stranger in a strange land. I mean, this still, when I'm in the States, my master wears home, I still feel that home is Vancouver. But when I come here, it's like I don't belong here anymore either. Like, it's a different place. But everyone, not everyone, many people I love are here. And so that piece of is still home.
Yeah. Well, this is a tremendous book. It's an engaging one that I'm really enjoying. Congratulations on it and continued good luck with it.
Thanks so much, Joe, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Just a correction for the interview. Dr. Wadman said that the risk of febrile seizures from the MMR vaccine can occur between 1 to 100,000 and 1 in a million. Dr. Wadman meant to say 1 to 100 and 1 to 100,000. The book is called The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. It's from Viking. Its author, Meredith Wadman, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.